Hi, I'm Neil Stavem. Thanks for checking out this podcast from Connecting Faith. You can hear the show live each weekday at noon Central Time, and there are many more podcasts for this and all our Faith Radio shows available online. Our web address is myfaithradio.com. And thanks for your gifts to this listener-supported ministry. Enjoy the podcast.
Always expect something good on your lunch hour. Connecting Faith with Life.
A blessed noon hour to you, and welcome to Connecting Faith. I'm Ryan Thomas, getting you set for a very special program today. As you may know, the Friday edition of our show is often a time for stories, where we hear how God is at work in remarkable ways in the lives of individuals who then turn around and make a big difference in the world around them. Today, it's another such story, but with a special twist. We're going to detail the journey of a young girl, raised in the upper Midwest, who finds herself in some remarkable places, from the mission field to the Miss America pageant, from long hours in a musical practice studio to the ministry, and from church offices to TV studios. This faith story is that of Jo Rath Manor, your host on Connecting Faith Fridays, and she'll tell it herself. You'll hear her in a moment. She gave these talks over 2 days in October of last fall, as a guest speaker at University of Northwestern St. Paul's Daily Chapel. And we present you an abridged version with respect to time today on Connecting Faith. Here's Jo.
I love introductions because they're just great. It's like this highlight reel of all the good things that you've done in your life. I almost feel like I should bring my little brother up and he could give a rebuttal so you kind of know who you're dealing with. But luckily, he's not here. Well, this is my fourth year of teaching at Northwestern, and I love it here. Y'all are so great. I have wonderful students. You're all hard workers, you know, with the exception of one or two, of course. You're probably not here. But I do love teaching here. I also love the weather, and I don't talk about it very much. And, of course, you all never ask professors personal questions, so you may not know that I am kind of a weather geek, and I love the fall. Even when it's like this, where it's rainy and awful outside, because I know that that moisture is just going to make those colors better in the weeks and days to come. So I love the fall. However, this last year was the year where I was never so grateful to not be a meteorologist anymore, because it was the one of the winter that did not end. I would start to feel bad for these poor people who would get up and say, there's more snow and cold on the way. And by April, even I was getting perturbed. I mean, I was ready to send a hate email, which I used to receive by the dozens per day, even when I was right. But by about April, I'm finally like, I've had enough of this winter. It needs to change into spring. And that's why I love Minnesota. Because no matter how long those seasons last, you know that there is something that's coming that is going to bring change to your life. I also have these seasons of my life that seem to kind of last forever sometimes. And in the fall, one season in particular always seems to rev up a little bit, and I love to call it my season of striving. I will have the most relaxing summer, wonderful relaxing time, and then all of a sudden about mid-August hits, and I start to think, I need to start doing more, working harder, working better, working faster. Like there's something I have to do to be more. It's my season of striving. I almost feel like I should join a support group or some sort of addiction recovery group. Like, I would stand up at the podium and say, my name is Jo. I'm a striveaholic. I can't seem to stop. It started really early in life for me, age 3, maybe 4. I got that first participation certificate from soccer. I got my scotch tape out. I put it up on my wall. Oh, I was so proud. It was just harmless stuff, really. I was experimenting. But by third or fourth grade, that addiction, it had taken over. I made my dad put up a bulletin board because I had to put all of my track and field ribbons up. You know, yellow, green, purple. But by fifth grade, those weren't doing it for me anymore. Nope. I had to have red or blue. And up on the wall they went. My need to achieve was becoming insatiable. By junior high, senior high, it was all a blur. basketball, volleyball, gymnastics, honor choir, orchestra, jazz band, jazz orchestra, math club. I mean, I was joining things I did not even care about because I wanted to put it up on my wall. It was terrible, but I had this quest to strive and achieve. I was deep into this season of striving. I blame my family. I blame my friends too. They enabled me in my addiction. They did. See, I grew up in a family with three brothers and no sisters. Anyone? It's awful, right? So I had no sisters. I had no role model. My mom was a PE coach and she called us home with a whistle. I am not kidding you. Everything was a competition in our family. How hard could you shoot a puck? How many baskets could you make? Who could win at Monopoly? How many beans could you eat at dinner? This one sometimes had some really nasty consequences. But it was all a contest for us. There was one girl in the neighborhood. First, I'll show you a little picture. These are kind of my little clan that I hung out with. Always a couple of my brothers, but then just a couple of other boys from the neighborhood, Bobby, Brian, and that's me over there on the left. I had my dog, so that was really what kept me going. I did have one girlfriend. Her name was Lumper. I can't tell you why. We drew blood, secret handshake. I said I'd never share. So Lumper and I would kind of hang together, but mostly we were with the boys. And at Lumper's house, she had this huge rock over by the side of her curb. The neighbors had dug it up while trying to dig a basement, and it was too big to transport. So they just pushed this thing over to the side of the road, and this rock was massive. I mean, it makes that Northwestern rock look like a skipping stone. This thing was huge. And on one side, it was kind of graduated to the top with these little curves, and it was nice and smooth. And this, of course, was the climbing side of the rock. The other side went straight down, and it was really rough. So if you hit your knee or scraped your hand, you were a goner. It was blood all over the place. So, of course, the game was King of the Mountain. Now, maybe some of you have played this game, but I grew up in an era where our moms kind of kicked us out of the house around 9 in the morning, and they did not expect to see us until about 6 o'clock at night. Do not come home, especially if you hurt yourself. Just stay away until 6 o'clock. So let's just say that our play was unsupervised, would probably be a good word. Now, I always had a hard time getting to the top of this rock. I was one of the smallest, as you saw by the picture, and my older brother was always just one step ahead. I could not seem to get past him. But one day, my season of striving, my striving addiction, it just took over, and I had to get to the top. So I had planned it out, and I just started going hard. My brother was a little bit ahead of me, but I just caught up to him and gave him the biggest headbutt I possibly could, and off he kind of fell to the side, a little bit dizzy, but I stammered on. Lumper was up next. She was even littler than me, so she was nothing. I just kind of gave her a little hip bump, and off she went. Brian was coming up fast. He put his hand down, and I just put my foot down with as much force as I possibly could, and he was out of there. The last one was Bobby. He was close to the top, and I knew I had to move fast if I was going to get him. So I crawled as fast as I could, and I got a hold of his ankle. And I thought, well, I could pull him down. I'm really not that strong. But instead, I just decided to push with my legs as hard as I could. And over the top, he went. And his body made this sad little thud. But it was okay because I made it to the top. And I was so excited, put my arms in the air. I expected cheering. I expected clapping. And you know they did not do that. They were not very happy, and there was no trophy. You ever tried just thinking about that maybe you wanted to get to the top so badly that you kind of forgot why you wanted to get there in the first place? I'd kind of forgotten that my friends were an essential part of my daily plane, but this was part of my addiction.
More of the faith story of Joe Rathmanner when we return on Connecting Faith.
Are you struggling to keep up with your fitness plans for the new year? We want to help. Join us for Commit to Live Fit 40-Day Challenge as Susie Larson leads you down a six-week journey of faith and fitness. During these next few weeks, we'll focus on physical and spiritual steps to a healthier life as you commit to live fit. Sign up for free at myfaithradio.com. It's not too late to sign up for Commit to Live Fit 40-Day Challenge.
It's encouragement and hope for your daily journey.
I think life is difficult enough, and it's really good when your day is going wrong or when your day is going right that you can either rejoice with what you're listening to or hold on to what you're listening to. And I have two small children, and it makes a difference to them. It changes my day, and it changes my life, and it strengthens my walk with the Lord, and I want to show and model that to my children.
Connecting your faith to your everyday life. Thanks for growing with us on Faith Radio.
Thanks for joining us for a special Connecting Faith Friday as we hear the remarkable faith story of your host, Joe Rathmanner. As told last October, she was a guest speaker in the Daily Chapel at University of Northwestern, St. Paul.
My striving nature, it followed me to college. I sought to be a star student, but I also sought to be a very fun student. It was not an either or for me, it was both and, because this was the pattern for my life. Maybe you have that as well. I wanted to be good at everything, but in the quest to be good at everything, my relationship with God really suffered. The first year and a half of college for me could be best described as schizophrenic, not because my mind was going different places, but because my behavior was very double-minded. I had my family at home, and I have to tell you, I had great parents. They taught us to love the Lord. They were awesome. I mean, I like to make fun of them a little bit because I have the microphone. But they were really God-honoring people. The problem was that I didn't always listen. I exactly remember the first time that I gave my life to Christ. It was junior high youth camp, Shores of St. Andrews. Maybe some of you have been there. Campfire. Probably happened to a few of you as well. I remember giving my life to Christ, and I had this overwhelming feeling of peace, like a burden had been lifted. I remember that feeling. I even wrote in my journal that weekend, I am going to try to stop hurting my brother. It was a big deal for me. But as a professor of college students, I wish I could say that I had just leaned into that experience. And I wish that I could look back on this incredible Christ-like example that I set, and I could teach you out of that and encourage you and challenge you out of that. But I have to say that my first couple years of college were not exactly transforming. Like I told you, even as a young person, I had this fixation on being successful at achieving whatever the highest award was at the time. I really cared about what people thought of me, much more than I thought what God thought of me, cared about what God thought of me. So by the time I got to college, I ended up being known for a lot of things that probably weren't very Christ-like. Sure, I had this pocket of students that I hung with from 8 in the morning until 5 in the afternoon. I was known for being smart. But at 5 in the afternoon, those friends kind of went by the wayside because I was always known for being up for a party too. And I was probably known for some things that I don't really want you to know about me. So I'm going to choose not to talk about those. But you probably get the picture. I really ran from God, and I was getting really tired. But what kept me going, what was in the back of my head, is that I had this experience where I remembered feeling peace, where I remembered feeling accepted, where I remembered feeling forgiven. So when I started to run away from him and experience this without God life, he stepped in and he intervened. I remember it was an average Saturday night. I had kind of started out with one group of friends, and we went to one party. And then we left that party, and I went with another group of friends to another party. And I left that party and went with another group of friends to another party. And by about 3 in the morning, I needed to go home. But I looked around at the sad state of affairs around me and said, no one here is going to be able to drive me home. So I made a decision that I was going to walk home. Now, I walked outside of this particular house in this particular neighborhood and realized I had no idea where I was. It was pitch black, and I thought, this is not good. So I just started walking, because you make these stupid decisions when you're in college, and thought, somehow I'm going to get home. I saw a river and a water tower, and I knew that my dorm was somewhere that way. And I just started walking down the path on the river. Now, this is bad for a couple of reasons. First of all, I wasn't quite sure where I was going. And secondly, we were told that the river was not a good place to be. That the river was a place where bad people hung out and bad things happened. However, it was my only choice. I come to find out later that I was about 6 miles from my dorm. So I got there just as the sun was coming up. But while I was walking, I just remember I started praying. And I'm like, God, I know that I haven't talked to you for a while. But I know that when I accepted you, you said that your Holy Spirit lives in me. So I'm just going to ask for some guidance right now that you can get me home and keep me safe. And then if you could just maybe make yourself known again, that'd be great. And I just kept walking. The next day, I'm not kidding you, Sunday, I get a call from a friend who was a lot more like a sister. She was actually my nanny growing up. And she invited me to church that night. She said, this woman's speaking. You need to hear her story. I think you need to come. And this was completely random because I had not heard from her for quite some time. So I got in my car and I drove back to the Twin Cities and I heard this woman speak. And I can't tell you what her story is. I can hardly picture her in my mind. But I remembered this. She spoke on Jeremiah 29:11, that God knows the plans he has for you, plans for good and not disaster, to give you a future and a hope. And it really struck a chord with me. She gave the invitation. People went up front. I did not. But I sat in my chair and I just said, all right, God, I know you heard me last night, even though I wasn't sure at the time, but I know you did. And I know you're hearing me now, and I just want to give my life back to you. And I swear I heard as clear as day in my head that the Holy Spirit just said to me, I do have a plan for you, but you got to get off that fence and you got to start coming back to me. And it was that easy and it was that hard to leave that season of kind of wavering back and forth and to enter that season of trusting him. But it didn't come right away, because I was still steeped in that striving addiction that I had. Even after I came to know the Lord, I still hadn't quite figured out who I really was in Christ. What did it really mean to live the truth of the gospel? Because I still thought that my value to him was still dependent on my performance. I figured I have to be pretty special if God's going to want to use me. I mean, the Bible says he wants to use me, but I got to be something kind of special. So I approached Christianity like I'd approach anything else and said, I've just got to be super amazing. What can I do that's going to be super amazing? I looked at my resume with, if you're 21, I mean, you think you've worked really hard in your life, but you look at your resume and you're like, okay, I've got some A's on my transcript. I've been in some clubs and I saved a boy from drowning once at a lake. I mean, that's all I had. So I'm thinking, all right, I got to do something spectacular. So one weekend I'm watching TV and it hit me. I knew exactly what I needed to do to be worthy of being used by God. I drove back home to my parents. I sat at dinner and my dad in his typical fashion said, what's new with you? And I said, oh, I've decided that I'm going to be Miss America. My dad kind of choked on his food and my brothers started laughing hysterically. And my mom just said, oh, we need to do something about that hair. Now, you have to understand, having grown up the way that I did, that if the talent competition had something to do with fishing or wrestling, I would be a shoo-in. However, walking in high heels, doing my hair in something other than a ponytail, and speaking intelligently on stage, I mean, they don't all speak intelligently on stage, but this was a goal for me, and I knew it was going to take some work. So after a couple of tries, I finally made it to the top five of the Miss Minnesota pageant. Now, you've all seen this, even if you pretend that you haven't. When you get to the top five, they bring you to the center stage, you know, and we're all holding hands, you know, like we're best friends. Right. And I'm just praying to God, God, thanks for getting me here. Man, this is going to be great. Now, if you could just not make me fifth place, that'd be great. So they call out fifth place, and it's Miss Stillwater. She takes her flowers, and, you know, she walks over to the side, and she's kind of waving to everybody, you know, like she won the whole thing. There's four of us left, and I'm just praying, God, thanks for not making me fifth. Now, if you could just not make me fourth, that'd be great. And they call out fourth, and then third, and then it's just me and Miss Cottage Grove. Now, I'm still holding her hand, but she's like 5'11 in 5-inch heels, so I'm like this. God, if I win, please don't let her hurt me. And they call out, the first runner-up is Miss Cottage Grove, and the winner is Joe Bender, Miss Rochester, and I'm just like, yes, yes! My brothers rush the stage, and I'm like running, giving them high fives, because I don't know what you're supposed to do at this point. And I look down at the Miss Minnesota board, and they just have their head in their hands. And I'm sure they're thinking, what just happened? But I know that this is all part of God's plan. 8 weeks later, I find myself at the Miss America pageant, and I am stressed out, but I'm in that same position. They're knocking us down to the top 10 finalists. They've called out 1 through 9, and I have not been called. So I am still standing there just praying, God, this is my plan. Don't wreck it. And they call out the 10th finalist is Miss Iowa. Anybody but Iowa. I mean, come on. Now, I happened to be standing next to her, so I did give her a little hug and, you know, kicked her on her way. And I walked in the backstage, and I was just bummed. I mean, my plan was not working. I felt like I had done so much to get ready for this, to get ready for how God was going to use me, that I just got gypped. I mean, I'd really changed my life. I had transformed it 180, but I was still thinking that what I was doing mattered to God. I'd given my life to Christ, but my mind hadn't quite caught on to the real meaning of the gospel. Pastor Tim Keller says, That's right before I gave the high fives. All right, here we go. Pastor Tim Keller says, once you turn your life over to Christ, you have to deliberately and repeatedly reset your mind to gospel mode. Repeatedly and deliberately reset your mind to gospel mode. I was still thinking that my worth was so tied to my performance that I had yet to change my mind. So I had yet to see this change that was supposed to take place in my life. Ever wonder if you keep score, you know, who prays the most, who comes to chapel the most, who works hardest, strongest, fastest, who has the most friends, who has the most followers? I mean, do you ever wonder if he kind of keeps track of those things? We put this amazing amount of pressure on ourselves to perform, to achieve, to be this ultimate Christian. But ultimately, we end up believing that lie, that if indeed our performance is, if our useworthiness is tied to our performance, then where is God anyway? The good news is we're not the first ones to struggle with this. I mean, people struggled with this 2,000 years ago. Remember James and John? They used to fight over who would sit at Jesus' right hand. The Romans, they had all that instruction from Paul on how to live the Christian life, and yet they continued to flounder, thinking that they had to be more, strive harder, build more, do more. Countless examples in the Bible show people who have yet to grasp this concept. The psalmist gives us excellent advice on the area of striving, of trying to do more. He says, be still and know that I am God. I love the New American Standard Version that says, cease striving and know that I am God. Concepts like being still, cease striving, these were not part of my vocabulary. They were very difficult for me to grasp. They were countercultural then, and they are countercultural for most of us now. Like many, I kind of thought this verse was supporting like meditative prayer or like getting away and unplugging for a while. These concepts also are not part of my daily regimen. So I wondered, is that really the lesson of Psalm 46:10? So as a teacher, I'm constantly telling students that you have to get back to the context. What did it first mean to that original audience? And I thought, well, I'd better do my homework here too. So the psalmist, who's most likely David, is talking to a nation at war. He's talking to them at a time when there have been some amazing battles and some amazing victories, but there is more to come. And during this time, he's telling the soldiers to be still. And the word from which be still is translated from, it creates this word picture of a soldier who takes his weapons and lays them down. He lets down his defenses and he rests. Now, it doesn't mean he's quitting, doesn't mean he's rolling over and letting the other side win, but it does mean that he is taking the time to let God do God's work. Being still is resting in the truth that nothing escapes God's notice. And nothing is beyond his power. He puts down his weapons, knowing that God is in control. Do you ever do that? Do you ever think about the plans you're making, maybe the things you're worrying about, whether it's a test, what you're going to do this summer, or what you're going to do for the rest of your life? Do you ever kind of take those things and just let them down, knowing that he is dependable and capable
to see you through whatever season it is that you are in. Pastor David Jeremiah writes, God will not put his hand on a difficulty until we take our hands off. He says it's only when we take our hands off that God will begin to work in such a way that we did not expect, but that we will know beyond a shadow of a doubt that he is indeed God.
It's much more of the story of God at work in the life of your host, Joe Rathmanner, when we return on Connecting Faith. Welcome back to a very special edition of our Friday version of Connecting Faith. It's often a place for compelling stories, how God is at work in an individual life, but how that life then reaches out and changes so many others. And today, it's another such story, but with a special twist. It's the journey of a young girl raised in the upper Midwest who finds herself in some truly remarkable places, from the mission field to the Miss America pageant, from long hours in a musical practice studio to the ministry, and from church offices to television studios. It's the faith story of Joe Rathmanner, and Joe is back right now on Connecting Faith.
This summer, I taught my 7-year-old to water ski, and he loves the water. He's been tubing for years, but water skiing was just something that kind of intimidated him. But then his older brother learned to drop a ski, and you know how that works. So all of a sudden, he needed to learn how to ski. And so any of you who've learned how to water ski, you know that getting up is definitely the hardest part. I mean, you're sitting there in the water, and I kept telling him, just sit like you're in a chair. Get those arms out. And it's very awkward because your feet are up. You can't kind of hold yourself up, so you'll tip to the side or tip to the other side. And then I kept telling him, when the boat goes, stay in your position and let the boat do the work. Do not stand up. But of course, the boat would go, he'd stand up, fall to the side. We'd get back on, I'd kind of hold him until the boat would go. The boat would go, he'd stand up and fall forward. We'd get back down. Sam, let the boat do the work. Stay in this position. The boat would go, he'd fall backwards. Finally, he got it. The boat went and pulled him right out of the water, and he remained like this, of course, for the entire road or the entire loop around the lake. But he made it, and he was just never so happy to be able to stand, knowing that the boat had pulled him up, and all he had to do was hang on and enjoy the ride. Some of us have these things that we don't want to let go of. We have these things, whether it's a plan, whether it's a purpose we think we have for our life, maybe it's a goal. But God is saying, let go and let me do the work. Let me do what I can do. We are to be still and know that he is God. So in the time I have left, I'm going to give you just a little bit of an action plan on how to cease from striving and know that we can rest in him. First, whenever we encounter a difficulty, release it into the care of the Lord. And scripture backs us up here multiple times. Here's just a couple of verses that I chose. Psalm 55, cast your burden on the Lord, and he will sustain you. He will never allow the righteous to be shaken. Didn't you hear that? He's never going to allow you to be shaken if you cast those burdens on him, your worries, your plans. Cast your anxiety on him because he cares for you, Peter writes. Do you believe that he cares for you? Do you believe that he cares for you enough that the things you're worrying about, you can just lay down and rest before him? So first, release that trouble to the Lord. And second, trust that he will act. Again, scripture backs us up. Psalm 37 says, commit your way to the Lord, trust him, and he will act. He will act, even if it doesn't make sense. I mean, I am all about logic. I like to figure things out. So this verse has been a life verse for me. Proverbs 3, 5, and 6, I'm sure you know it by heart. Trust in the Lord with all your heart and lean not on your own understanding. Now, you're all smart, intelligent people. Your own understanding is pretty spectacular. But in this case, he's saying, don't trust on your own understanding. In all your ways, acknowledge him. He will make your path straight. So first of all, we have to give it up to him. Secondly, we need to trust that he will act. I mentioned that after I came home from Miss America, I was wondering, what in the world am I going to do? Because now I am a loser and you're not going to use me. But during that year, during those 9 months between coming back from Miss America and going back and giving up my title, I wrote up this little program and said, you know what, maybe I can go to elementary schools and talk a little bit about bluegrass music and tell them they're great and tell some stories. And it worked. And so I was on the road for 5 or 6 days a week. The problem was that these little communities that would hire me to come to their schools, they could not afford to put me up in the Holiday Inn or the Super 8 or anywhere else. So instead, they'd have these host families who would host me for the week that I was there. 9 out of 10 times, these host families were the pastor and their family. And so I'd get to stay week after week in these really strong Christian homes where I saw strong men and women of faith who were living out God's example for them. They were showing me what it meant to be an adult Christian in this world. So did God use me? I don't know, but he grew me. And he definitely developed in me a strong faith and purpose for loving and modeling that Christ-like example that they had given me. So even when it doesn't make sense, to trust in him. So release your trouble to the Lord, trust that he will act, and finally wait. I don't know about you, but I hate waiting. I hate waiting in line. I hate waiting at the doctor's office. I hate waiting at Caribou. I will drive up to Caribou and I will have to make an assessment. Do I go in? Do I get in the drive-thru? What do I do? So I'll drive past so I can see inside and then have to make the call. Now, I will make the call to maybe go in. But the whole time I'm in ordering my drink, waiting for it to come, I am watching that car that used to be in front of me to see if they get out before I get my coffee. And if they do, it ruins my entire day. I know it's sick. I am sick. I hate waiting. Nobody likes waiting. But waiting is this key ingredient that God has designed for us to develop character and spiritual maturity. Waiting promotes these things in us. And God knows that way too well. So if we do these things, if we commit our plans to the Lord, if we trust that he will act on our behalf, if we wait for him, what can we expect to get? I had told you at the beginning of my talk that I remembered this time of committing my life to the Lord, that I felt that I had rested, that I felt this amazing sense of peace and calm. If we do these things, what we will find is rest. I am taken back to that frightful walk along the river, and I did not know what to expect, but I had this idea of what it meant to rest in him. I love what Jesus says about striving and resting. He says, are you tired? Are you worn out? Are you burned out? Come to me, get away with me, and you will recover your life. You'll recover your life. That is a big statement. I'll show you how to take a real rest. Walk with me and work with me. Watch how I do it and learn the unforced rhythms of grace. I won't lay anything heavy or ill-fitting on you. Just keep company with me and you'll learn to live freely and you'll learn to live lightly. Learn to live freely and lightly. That is something that's worth striving for.
Thanks for joining us for a special Connecting Faith Friday, the conclusion of the story of Joe Rathmanner as told in Daily Chapel at University of Northwestern St. Paul is right after a break in the action here on Connecting Faith. We'll be right back.
Hi, I'm Dick Whitworth, General Manager of Faith Radio. Are you new to the station? Well, welcome. It's great to have you tuning in. We have a new listener packet that's designed for friends just like you. It tells you a little bit about the station, who we are, why we exist, and what we're hoping to accomplish in the Upper Midwest. It's yours free for the asking at myfaithradio.com. Check it out. It's myfaithradio.com. It's the new listener packet. Request yours today.
Welcome back to Connecting Faith, and thanks for joining us for a special Connecting Faith Friday as we hear the remarkable faith story of our host, Joe Rathmanner, as told last October as a guest speaker in the Daily Chapel at University of Northwestern St. Paul. Here's the conclusion of Joe's remarks.
As a meteorologist, I like to kind of compartmentalize things in my life with seasons. And I was just talking about how I was immersed in this season of striving. And every fall, it kind of comes back. It comes back not gradually, but just with a big bang. About the second week of August, all of a sudden, I start feeling all of this pressure on these things I need to do to get better, to get stronger, to revise things, to be just the best professor I can possibly be. And maybe you have that same kind of feeling about striving as a student. And I talked a little bit about how I didn't quite grasp that meaning of what it means for God to be truly accepting of who I am, the way that I am, that I needed to instead start to look at who he was and who I was because of him, so that we could not be in the season of striving, but learn to be still. And that Psalm 46:10 was just a key verse for my life, to learn to put down all my plans, all the things that I thought were important, and be still. And that is when God will start to move in your life. And I hope that you are finding that this year, as you have probably been in that season of striving as well, that now it might be time to let some of those things go and let God begin to work in your life. There are times, though, when you don't get to be still, times when we have to make some really tough decisions. And I know that as a college student, as a young adult, you are in a season of decision making. There are lots of choices that you have to make on a daily, monthly, yearly basis. And some of those decisions are really easy. You get up, you decide what you're going to wear, where you're going to go for lunch. Do I turn in that paper that's due? These things are pretty easy. But there are some decisions that are a lot more complicated. Like, you already made the decision of where to go to college, but maybe you're deciding, what do I major in? What do I want to do with my life? Do I want to study abroad? Do I want to take on more student loans? And then once you make those decisions, then you have a whole nother set of decisions. What do I do now that I have my degree? Where do I want to work? Do I want to buy a house? Do I want to get married? When and to who? Well, hopefully you decide who, and then you decide when. That would probably be the proper way to make decisions. But sometimes these decisions, they come at you rapid fire, and you get a little bit confused, and you need some assistance. So how do we make wise decisions? I brought along with me some ways that people use to make decisions. I have to admit I've used some of them at some point in my life. Anyone know what this is? Magic 8 Ball. Yes, this is actually mine from when I was a kid, so you can barely read it. But I remember sitting around in fifth grade at slumber parties saying things like, does Bobby like Susie? It is most certainly so. See? Or I'll say like, am I going to be tall when I grow up? I'm still asking this one, by the way. You can rely on it. See, there's hope. There's hope for me. Or like, will those Vikings ever win a game? Yeah. I know, that's a tough one. Ooh, it is certain. It is certain. Yes, so there is hope. There is hope, according to my magic eight ball. Now, maybe there's some other things you use. Like, this is, my son made this when he was six. Have you ever used one of these things? Mm-hmm. Now, my son went to a cute little Montessori school, so this is actually called a compliment thing, a compliment something. So when you open it up, it says, you are a good peacemaker, or you are a good friend, you're nice. So, you know, I've seen these before where things are not so nice. So sometimes you might use this to make a decision. It's kind of like doing rock, paper, scissors. All right, anyone seen these? Anyone know what these are? Ah, wait, what if I take them out? My mom told me if I ever took these out and handled them, they'd burst into flames. But anyone see any of these? Tarot cards, right? Sometimes people, look, they're not bursting into flames, but I'm kind of nervous, so I'm just going to put them back. Some people use tarot cards in order to make some decisions. If a card falls, then that's going to decide what they're going to do for their life. I have some other ways that I found. Palm reading, of course. People use this to make some big decisions in their life. People do this today. I went to a bridal shower a couple of months ago, and our entertainment for the day was a palm reader. And I had somewhere that I needed to be really quickly. So there's astrology. Of course, people will look at their horoscopes every day, and that may help them to make a decision. If your horoscope says that you're going to be able to have victory in a discussion today, you might decide that's the day to confront or have a conflict with someone.
Other people, of course, there's the crystal ball, and this is from my favorite movie, The Wizard of Oz. You can see the flying monkeys kind of holding the crystal ball up. Now, there's also one that I found. Drew mentioned that I was a meteorologist. I spent a long time training for that and then a long time doing it. But if I would have known that I could have gotten this, check it out. It's a weather fortune teller app. I mean, for $1.99, I could have just put this thing on my phone and always looked at that, never having to look at a chart, graph, map again. So that would have been a really good way for me to make decisions as a meteorologist or not. So how do we make wise decisions? Author Todd Smith says, the decisions you make today will form the person you become tomorrow. Maybe not every decision, but some of those big decisions that you make today may form the person that you become tomorrow. So I have two questions for you today. How do we get the wisdom that we need to make wise decisions? And then how does God actually deliver that wisdom to us? How do we know that we actually got it? So I wanted to look at what the book of James had to say about making decisions. How do we get the wisdom that we need to make good decisions? James says, if any of you lacks wisdom, you should ask God, who gives generously to all without finding fault, and it will be given to you. But when you ask, you must believe in that doubt, because the one who doubts is like a wave of the sea blown and tossed by the wind. That person should not expect to receive anything from the Lord. Such a person is double-minded and unstable in all that they do. James is writing to a group of people who know God, but recently have found out who Jesus is and what it is that his life has represented for them. They want to know, how am I supposed to live now? How am I supposed to live now that's different than what I was living before? The book of James is kind of a guideline for living. How do I live in light of what Jesus has done for me? But they're also in a terrible trial. They're facing something that is causing deep distress. And so James is writing to them that there is a way to get help, and that the help comes from God, that our God is a good God who wants to give generously to those who ask. And when you're in trial, when you're in trouble, or when you're under pressure to make a decision, that's when we don't always make the wisest decisions. I have found that the times I feel the most regret in my life are when I have made a snap decision. Some are very easily fixed, like if I'm shopping at the mall and I am enticed by the smell and what I see and the credit card burning a hole in my pocket, and I see a $450 pair of boots that I just have to have because they look really nice. I might buy them and go home, and then I put them on and there is no good smell that is enticing me any longer, and I realize that when that bill comes, I am not going to want to pay it. So the next day I can rectify that decision. I can take them back. Some decisions are that easy to fix, but other decisions, snap decisions that I've made, have caused irreparable harm in my life. Like if I make a decision to reply, send a very curt reply to an email that kind of hurt my feelings, and I actually push send. Anyone ever done that? Ouch. Or making the decision not to hold my tongue or to speak out in anger at someone who said something that's hurtful to me. Sometimes we make decisions that are unwise. I know I have. So these relatively new Christians that James is talking to, he's trying to prevent that. He's trying to prevent them from making unwise decisions, because our God will give us wisdom. Anyone felt like you could ever use some wisdom? You know, felt like you're a little short in that department? Anyone ever felt like the person next to you could use some wisdom? Maybe they're a little short in that department? Yeah. Thomas Jefferson said that honesty is the first chapter in the book of wisdom, that we need to be honest with ourselves, that we do not possess as much wisdom as we would like. So back to James, he writes that God stands ready to give this kind of wisdom, that he stands ready to give it when we ask. So the first way, of course, that we can get wisdom, the first step to take is to ask God. He says, if any of you lacks wisdom, you should ask him, because God gives generously. James says, we don't have to be afraid. We don't have to be ashamed, for God is anxious to answer, and he will not scold us for doing so. You know, I ask for wisdom every day. It seems like every day I am lacking, whether it's how to deal with my kids on a situation, whether it's what I'm going to say for a lecture, how to deal with a disgruntled student, not that I ever have those, but just in case, whether it's what I'm going to say during a talk. I am always asking God for wisdom. I have one son who hates conflict. He is 8, and he just wants everyone to love everybody. So he loves to have fun. He also hates to be told no. So rather than ask for something directly and have me say no, he likes to come up with these statements, hoping that I will somehow come up with a solution to whatever problem he has, giving him permission to do something without him ever asking for it. Case in point, we have some video game rules in our house. My 8-year-old loves his iPod Touch, loves his Nintendo DS, loves really anything that has a screen on it. But he knew that his time had already been used up for the day. So he comes into my office and he's like, "Mom, I really need some exercise." And I'm like, "Great, hop on your bike, you know, go take a ride." And he's like, "My legs are tired, Mom. I mean, today we played soccer in gym, and then I ran home from the bus stop, and oh, my legs are tired. I don't know that they can exercise. But my hands could use some exercise. Is there anything that I could do that would allow me to sit and rest my legs but use my hands?" So, of course, I tell him, "I've got some envelopes to stuff or some buttons to sew on, and you can join me." And he does not like that very much. But he doesn't want to hear me say no. This is the exact opposite approach that our Heavenly Father has for us. He's saying, if you need wisdom, ask him, because he gives generously to all without shaming, without reproach, without finding fault. In 1 John, John writes, come on, John, that we have this confidence that we have toward him, that if we ask anything according to his will, that he hears us. And he does. That he hears what we ask for and wants to give that to us. So first, ask him. Second, ask in faith. Believe that this is going to happen. James not only explained what to ask for, but how to ask for it. He says that we should ask in expectation. We should ask in faith. He said, for the person who doubts, the person that doesn't suppose he will receive anything from the Lord is double-minded. He is unstable in all his ways. Do you know anyone who's kind of a doubter? Who's always kind of unstable? Who makes decisions like willy-nilly what they're going to do? And they're probably not that person you call when you really need some wisdom or advice. You don't want to be that person. The person who is the doubter. My husband has an aversion to heights. I promised him I wouldn't say fear. So he has an aversion to heights. Now, it would be nice if I knew this. However, after 3 years of dating and 3 months of marriage, I still did not know this until I planned a really romantic day where we would go for a ride in a hot air balloon. I did not tell him about this, of course, until we drove up to the hot air balloon and started walking across the field. And then it was quite obvious that that is what we were going to do. And he started to just become this kind of white-looking face thing. And finally I said, "Do you not want to go in a hot air balloon?" And he said, oh, no, I can do it. I'm good, because you planned this thing, totally on board. So then the guy starts giving instructions, and these instructions were kind of complicated. I don't know if you've ever done this, but I was starting to feel the weight of, wow, if I don't do these things, we could die. And if I was feeling that way, well, imagine what my husband looked like. So I was listening and trying to figure out, how can I do his job and my job and still land? Okay, I've got it all. I was doing the best that I could. And then we went up in the balloon. And he put his hand on one side of the basket and his other hand on the other side of the basket. And this is how he remained white-knuckled for the entire 45 minutes that we were up in this balloon ride. I had my camera, and I was, like, taking pictures and looking down and leaning over, and he was kind of not amused. So it came to the end of the hot air balloon ride, and the guy started shouting instructions on what we were supposed to do. And the main thing we had to do was pull this rope that was kind of about this high and pull it as hard as we could. And then from him pulling, me pulling and my husband pulling, it was supposedly supposed to bring the basket down very gently to the ground. Well, my husband remained in the position that he was in and would not pull on the rope. And I said, honey, you got to pull on your rope. No, it's not going to work. And I'm like, you got to pull on your rope. He's like, no. So finally, I tried to reach his, but I got mine. You know, I'm a little person. I'm really not that strong. I could barely get mine pulled down. And the guy pulled his down. And so our little basket started going like this, and then it went like this. And he's up on the top side because he has not let the air out that has allowed. So now he's above me like this. And I'm just kind of like this. And the thing hits the ground. And we bounce along the ground for about 30 feet before this guy can get a hold of that other rope and finally bring us to a stop of some sort. That was 14 years ago. We are still married. But it did definitely cause us some subjects for discussion. But I said later, why didn't you just pull the rope? And he said, I just didn't trust that it would work. He just didn't trust that it would work. James says, do not doubt. Ask God for wisdom and know that he is going to give it to you. Do not be a doubter, because a doubter is tossed back and forth like the waves on the sea. Do not doubt, or we are double-minded. Maybe you have a huge decision to make. Maybe you have a very tight time frame and you are weighed down by the amount of decisions that you have to make. Don't doubt that he will help you make those decisions. It was doubt that made Peter sink as he walked out on the waves. He started out so strong. He got out of the boat. He focused on Christ. But then the waves came and the wind came up. And as he started to doubt, he began to sink. James says, don't doubt. Be sure that God will answer you. So James says, if any of you lack wisdom, you should ask God for it and do not doubt that he will get it.
And thank you so much for joining us for a special edition of Connecting Faith. We hope you enjoyed and were impacted by the story of our host, Jo Rathmanner, as she told it herself as a guest speaker at the chapel, the Daily Chapel, at University of Northwestern St. Paul. If you'd like to learn more about University of Northwestern St. Paul and their Daily Chapel, you can visit unwsp.edu. And as always, if you didn't have a chance to hear the full program today, you can visit myfaithradio.com. Under Programs, look for Connecting Faith to hear the podcast later today. And for Jo Rathmanner, I'm Ryan Thomas. Thanks so much for being with us on Connecting Faith. Have a blessed weekend, and we'll see you back here on Monday.